Subway has teamed up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for $5 to participating Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See store for details. Subway. Eat fresh.
Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. This is the summer that I have inexplicably fallen for soccer. I can't explain it. I don't know why it happened now. I don't know if it's like a little bit of a midlife crisis, but I have thrown myself into the U.S. national team in the English Premier League. And now, one of the most famous American soccer players of all time, Alexi Lalas. Welcome to the BS Report.
Thank you.
What's going on?
You don't have to explain it. It's like, it's like love. You know, it just happens. You just got to go with it.
You got to go with it, and I think you can't be a casual soccer fan. You either have to throw yourself into it or not follow it, I feel like.
Like
you
love.
Agree?
Yeah.
You agree? Like, there's so many subtleties to it.
I think if you're going to do it, especially if you're an American, you know, that hasn't grown up with it, if you're going to do it, you know, definitely do it, you know? I mean, don't just go in and kind of get your foot wet, you know, jump in.
Right.
And you've done that, so congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Let's talk about the American team first, because you and I never met you until we were in Mexico. You were there working the game, and I was there to write a column, and we ended up getting Montezuma's Revenge from the same restaurant, which I think has bonded us really for life.
Without a doubt. I mean, you were there. We were both working, but, you know, there was plenty of tequila involved.
There was tequila. I don't think that the combo of tequila and Montezuma really helped. In fact, I don't think I've ever felt worse. I think it's the closest I've ever felt to death the next day.
Yeah.
Being hungover with Montezuma.
It was so stereotypical. It was like, you know, can we be more of a cliche? But it was horrible.
You were not happy with the way the American team played. How much of it had to do with the stadium, and how much of it had to do with the urgency of the Mexican team, and how much of it had to do with just them having an off day?
We went down to Mexico City, and for those that don't know, Azteca Stadium down there is very, very difficult to play, and the U.S. has never won there. Combination of you're playing against a good Mexican team, you're playing at altitude, you're playing in a city that's renowned for its pollution and smog, and it's hot. It wasn't the hottest of days, and in all these things, it's not like they just jumped out at the U.S. Everybody knows about it. It's something that you can prepare for a certain extent. They didn't play a great game, but I think they did enough to get the point. You know, they were 8 minutes away from getting a 1-1 tie, which would have been a great result. But to be honest, I think what the biggest problem was that their possession in the midfield was non-existent. And at some point, probably in any sport, you have to be able to not just withstand the onslaught, but then establish some rhythm and establish some possession the other way, because you can't defend the entire game. And that's literally what happened for the U.S. They didn't have any of the ball. They got an early goal, which wasn't something that they had planned on, and then they defended the rest of the game. And eventually Mexico wore them down. The elements were a factor to a certain extent, but, Mexico was the better team on the day.
But, I mean, if those teams played 10 times, wouldn't Mexico have that time of possession every time?
Not really. I mean, I think when the U.S. plays against Mexico in either a neutral site or certainly in the U.S. in different places, the possession starts to equal out a little bit. But, you know, Mexico has players that love to keep the possession with one and two touching and little passing. The U.S. is much more direct, European more in terms of the style of play. But, you know, when you're running around trying to catch your breath down in Azteca, and they're running you rampant all over the place, it's difficult. And they feed off of that, and the crowd feeds off of that possession, because they know that at some point they're going to break through and that goal's going to come.
Now, you said you love playing in atmospheres like that.
Love it. Love it.
Like, it was like your favorite thing about soccer, basically.
Yeah, I don't care, you know, if people are screaming for me or screaming against me, as long as they're screaming. And, you know, we've played down in a lot of those places, and people are throwing stuff and calling you horrible names and all sorts of craziness. I love it.
I didn't even realize when I was at the game, every time Tim Howard kicked the ball, the crowd yelled something, and I didn't know what it was, but then I found out that it was a really offensive name, or a nickname, or a derogatory name, whatever, but I didn't know that at the time, but each time he kicked it, they yelled this, and I was like, oh, that's cute, what are they yelling? And I was like, oh no. So how would
you
rank
the... Tim thought it was cute, but yeah, I don't know, I mean, I think that if you're an athlete, if you're a good athlete, I think some of the best athletes feed off of even the negative, type of environment, and they like, yeah, bring it on. You want to scream and yell at me? Fine. And then I'm going to do something that you're going to at least have to respect whether you like me or not.
The irony of that game is that it really did turn out to be a home field advantage because the guy, not to point out Donovan, but his guy did create that second goal and he didn't have the legs to keep up with him. And it was a weird play. It was like, wow, is he tired? And then it turned out he had swine flu. So it was really the ultimate home field advantage. They actually gave him a flu created in Mexico that led to the game-winning goal.
Yes, but to be fair to the Mexicans, he did not get it in Mexico, so it was infiltrated, and then he actually contracted it back in the United States,
right?
And then went down there with the swine flu, and we found out about this later.
Right.
And yeah, certainly any kind of flu is debilitating, even for a young guy who's in shape, and I think he felt it on the day. But is that the reason why the U.S. lost?
No.
Absolutely. Would have been nice to have Landon, being 100%, of course. And I think even Landon Donovan couldn't necessarily, change the way that things went that day.
Yeah, it was one of those games that just the chances were adding up. And at some point, it's one of the things I like about soccer is eventually it evens out. You're rarely going to see one team dominate and repeatedly get those chances and the other team win. I think that actually is a little more common in hockey. In hockey, you could see one team dominate, but then the other team will just get some fluke goal, and it's just devastating to the team that was dominating. But in soccer, it's a little bit harder.
It is harder, but, you do have those moments, and I've played in them where you are just kind of batten down the hatches and defend the whole game and then look for that one counterattack. It can be incredibly frustrating because, in basketball or in football, I mean, if you have all the possession and all the ball, you're gonna get points and you're gonna ultimately win. But soccer is a game about rhythm. It's not about just the money shot at the end with the goal. It's about how you build up and how you wear down an opponent and do all those things. And these are all nuances that you're gonna learn as you go on. They're not readily apparent just for someone who's just come into the game, but you'll get a feel for it and you'll get an appreciation for it too.
What is the – give me like your top four toughest places that you played. Was Azteca like
Azteca was one of them. Down in Saprissa Stadium down in Costa Rica is very, very difficult to play. They're even much more crazy down there. They're not as big. It's not as big a stadium, but they're right on top of you.
How is that possible? They could be crazier.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it is. Maybe just, Costa Ricans. I don't know what it is. But, I think that they built that stadium where the fans are right on top of you. They made you run this gauntlet, where you come out of the locker room. And it's one thing when you're coming out of the locker room, but when you're going back into the locker room where the fans can actually anticipate your movement.
Right.
So they gear up and get all the projectiles ready. And then you just kind of run through this crazy gauntlet, like I said, where, you have riot police and dogs and all this crazy stuff. So it was interesting getting off the field.
We talked about it at dinner. We talked about, why wouldn't America create a soccer stadium that would kind of serve some of these same purposes? Because the thing that really struck you about, or struck me about Azteca was the fans really are on top of the field. It's a stadium specifically constructed for soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And if we built like a 60,000 seat stadium just for soccer that had that same effect, it really would be a home field advantage. Now, somebody said at dinner, that's kind of what Jerry Jones did with his new stadium, right?
Well,
that's
what he tried to do. I mean, I think he based the size of it and the scope of it on Azteca. I mean, when you walk into Azteca, whether it's full or whether it's empty, there is this, you catch your breath, and it's not the altitude.
Yeah.
I mean, it literally is that massive. And I constantly described it like this, beyond Thunderdome type of thing when you walk into this environment. Problem is that when you spend $1.2 billion and you're from the American culture and you have, a massive video screen, I mean, all of these are just kind of fluff things, and what they serve to do is take away, from some of the organic type of cheering and support that some of these people have. Plus, you know, the American sports culture, in the way that we cheer for our teams and the way that we support our teams, is very, very different. It doesn't mean that there's not passion, but there's something very, very different about soccer and about soccer supporters.
Yeah, I made the case in last week's column that here we have 30 different sports and college and pro and all different types of things. So we're constantly going from one sport to the next, where in a place like Mexico, soccer is it's really it. It's all the sports combined into one.
Yeah,
so the games
I played over in Italy, and there's two things that happen on Sunday, soccer and religion, and it's absolutely no coincidence. And you wouldn't be caught dead showing up late to a soccer game or getting in front of somebody to get, a hot dog or something like that.
Right.
It is about the 90 minutes that goes on the field. And a lot of these stadiums, you know, are very, very big, but they're very, very, minimalistic and bare bones in terms of their approach. That's changing a little bit with the culture and the way generations work. But, you know, it's still very, very different in terms of an environment going to a sporting event at a World Cup or going to a sporting event overseas as opposed to going to one over here.
Well, I wonder if maybe it really seems like Seattle is responding to soccer.
Yep.
Because I feel like we need a capital. We need a capital of U.S. soccer, and we need to figure out what's going to be the city where we have our big games and that people just kind of know that's where it's at. Maybe it's Seattle because their football stadium really holds the noise. I don't know if it would translate as well to soccer, but they certainly have shown the support. You know,
they've done incredible. I mean, they've made a certain case that is like, Soccer Town USA or whatever you want to call it, for the support that they have for the Sounders over there and what they've done on and off the field with that organization. The one problem that they have is that they play on a synthetic surface. Now, soccer needs to be played on grass, and the U.S., in order to have a home base, if you will, would have to have a grass field, I would think. That would be very, very important. But I think in the future, they're going to find a way to put that team on grass. It's just gotten so big. And they did it absolutely right. They recognized that soccer is no longer just this underground type of niche sport. It's become above ground, but there is an incredibly educated public out there. And they had to make it organic, and they had to make it authentic. And we've tried to dumb it down and kind of Americanize it in so many ways, so many times, and it really doesn't work.
Right. And, one of the most fascinating things about this season is that the MLS team that's probably in doing the most disappointing in terms of attendance and response or whatever is the New York-New Jersey team.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the Red Bulls, for those that don't know, unfortunately, that's part of the problem is that there is no relevance in the New York market, which is disappointing because you have to have that regardless of what your sport. You know, the Red Bull took over the Metro Stars as they were a few years ago. They're opening a brand new stadium. It's actually going to be an awesome stadium in New Jersey next year. But the problem is that the team on the field and the product literally on the field has been so poor that, they have absolutely no traction right now. They don't really know exactly who they are, and they're moving into this wonderful stadium. That's a problem. It's a problem for the league and obviously a problem for Red Bull.
Do you foresee maybe – is that team going to make it even with the new stadium?
You
work for them, right?
I did. I actually was there when the takeover happened. So I was the GM of the Metro Stars. And then Red Bull came in, and then I came back to the Galaxy. New York is a hard market, and I would never tell somebody how to do their job. It's very, very difficult. As you know, you have so many different things, a lot like Los Angeles, and breaking through it is not easy. Having said that, who are they on the field, and who are they off the field? I think that this stadium, when people see it, is great, but it's still just a package.
Yeah.
I mean, you can put the blue box on the ring, and that certainly elevates it a little bit, but ultimately it's got to be about what's inside that package. And right now they're not doing enough to entice people. And it's a very savvy soccer market over there in New York. They understand their soccer, and they want to see stars, and they want to see something big, and they want to see a competitive team.
See, I think it's mostly the Meadowlands would be why I think that it wouldn't be taking off, because that's such a tough place to get in and out of. Even going to a Jets-Giants. Yeah, going to a Jets-Giants game is a nightmare. Like, why would you want to put up with that if you're a casual soccer fan? You wouldn't. So, in L.A., you go to Carson.
That's the cool thing about this new stadium in Harrison, in New Jersey, because you can get on the path in downtown New York and take it, 20 minutes, you're there. And it's going to be a real urban type of stadium, but it's going to enable people to go and see see the team and see a quality event at this stadium from Manhattan very, very easily without taking the taxis and the buses and all the other different things that you have to do. And that's been our huge problem. They play in a, you know, the Giant Stadium's 80,000 people or whatever. And when you put 20,000, which is actually a very, very good crowd for MLS, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm not willing to count out that market. I think the stadium in Harrison is really intriguing. And as long as it's easy to get to and can pull in, you know, I think that's why in L.A., the putting the stadium in Carson, which is like about, you know, 25 minutes from L.A., but it's pretty easy to get to. There's not too much traffic. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been able to draw a little bit for the two teams. Now, you were here when the whole Beckham thing happened.
Yes, I was.
You were working for the Galaxy at the time.
I was, yeah. Yes,
and
knee-deep in it.
Knee-deep, that's a good way to put it.
In it, whatever it was.
you're prominently starred in Grant Wall's book called The Beckham Experiment, which is a very good read.
The book, yes.
Do you think, looking back, do you think that this Beckham thing, success, failure, work in progress, or something else?
I think in big picture type of, situation, it was a complete success. I mean, you had to do it for what it did for the Galaxy brand, both in terms of what people can see and then, you know, behind the scenes, which is what I was privy to. 100%, you have to do it. It was wonderful. The Galaxy brand is now known worldwide because of the association with Beckham. What it did to all the other teams in terms of the crowds and the people in seats and the attention and the focus, and, you know, we talk about relevancy all the time. It's been wonderful. Was the league or the Galaxy prepared for doing that and structured to do that? Probably not. Plenty of mistakes were made, including by myself. And you know, had we to do it over again, it would be a lot easier because now we have the experience and the understanding of doing something like that. I think the salary cap and the difficulties of having a player who's so highly paid and has, you know, just takes so much oxygen out of the room,
yeah.
And, you know, have him sitting next to guys that aren't making anything is difficult. But, you know, this is, as they say, an experiment. And, you know, experiments have ups and downs and successes and failures throughout it all. But I think all told, when we look back, it will be looked at as, you know, one of these platforms that we used to increase the, you know, the understanding and the knowledge about not just the Galaxy, but of Major League Soccer and soccer itself in the United States.
Well, in the book, you know, they kept making the point that for whatever reason, the mainstream media just totally and inaccurately reported what that contract was worth. People really think like he made $250 million or whatever it was, and actually, like, it wasn't anything close to that.
Yeah, I mean, it was, creative accounting or you know, loose interpretation of what somebody actually makes. You know, the salary was not even close to that. But, you know, what it meant to him in terms of his endorsements, in terms of the people that wanted him to go over the United States was immense. You know, it was an uncharted territory. It was certainly a market that, and when I say it, I'm not just talking about Dave, I'm talking about the brand of Beckham.
Yeah.
It was, you know, an opportunity that they felt, you know, was something that they could really, really capitalize on. And to a certain extent, they have.
Well, do you think at that point in his career, do you feel like maybe he thought, all right, I'm on the downside of my career, this is a good time to do this? But then actually he wasn't. Like, he had a really good season abroad.
Yeah, it was interesting. I definitely think that, you know, the fact that he was out of the picture for the England national team, didn't see himself being involved in it, let alone being involved in the next World Cup, although he always wanted to, and I believe it's an incredible source of pride for him to represent the country.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the coach gets changed. His old coach from Real Madrid shows up as the England coach, brings him in. He's playing well. He's, you know, he has this this new energy and this new belief that, hey, I can actually be involved in the World Cup. Damn. You know,
right.
And that's why, you know, this whole thing with Milan, you know, with his loan over to Milan, and, you know, that's completely understandable. I would never begrudge him the opportunity to represent, you know, his country in a World Cup. The problem that I have is that, you know, you made your bed and either lay in it or move on to some other bed. But, you know, he's kind of has one foot in two beds, and that's a little difficult for Galaxy fans to understand. It's not that he's not a good player, and to a certain extent, it's not even that he doesn't make the team better when he's with the team. But, you know, there is, you know, this icky type of feeling that that it's not the type of commitment that that Galaxy fans want to see. And, you know, they would much rather maybe see a player that isn't as good but is completely 100% committed to the team.
Yeah, there's a sense he's slumming it a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, it's a little difficult to take. You know, he's playing well. The Galaxy is a much better team this year, so that certainly helps. But, you know, there's a bigger picture. You know, I mean, we're constantly being viewed by many people around the world as a second-rate league, and I don't believe that that's the case at all. But when these types of things happen, yeah, you know, I get a little upset.
You're right. Right. And, you know, in retrospect, was he the right guy to do this with?
He's the only guy we could have done it with. I mean,
you don't think there's anybody else that it could have worked with?
No, because first off, there's nobody else that sells tickets the way he does, that attracts attention the way he does, and has the ability on the field. Is he the best soccer player that the league has ever seen? Absolutely not. Is he a good soccer player? Yes. And does he make the Galaxy better when he's on the field? Yes. So I think, you know, once again, going back to that initial question, yes, it was the right thing to do because there's nobody that could have had this type of explosiveness on and off the field than him. And there's nobody since. I mean, if you said, well, let's do it with somebody else now, who are you going to do? There's nobody that has this incredible off-field persona and attraction as well as, you know, the ability on the field.
I think the fundamental problem is that the stuff that he does on a soccer field isn't something that casual fans can totally grasp. Like, even it was like his second or third game this season I was watching. He had the ball at midfield and kind of did that telepathic thing with Donovan, and Donovan just started streaking. And he just hit him on a line, like 45 yards downfield. It was a perfect pass. They scored. I don't know if, you know, even me, I'm still learning about soccer. I can barely appreciate, like, how hard of a play that was.
Yeah. It's hard. But, that comes with time, and that comes with watching games. So at least you can now acknowledge it. But
yeah,
there will come a point, I guarantee, where you'll even be at the point where if you watch a game with people that know about the game, at times a team will come out of their defensive end and be able to break pressure and, you know, change the point of attack or get out of a jam. And people will clap because they will appreciate that. I mean, it takes a while to understand those types of things, but you will. And,
yeah.
I think the more soccer that you watch, the more you will understand about the game. And it's not a fast food game. It doesn't just spoon feed it to you. It makes you work for it, and it can be frustrating. And it's very subjective in the rules and the way everything's interpreted. And it's not just a simple here, take the ball and run it into this area.
The one advantage I have is just from growing up with Larry Bird and just the way the Celtics team played. And you know, you watch that long enough as a fan, and you can kind of see the plays developing before they develop. And I think soccer is like that, too. And it's such a similarity that I actually can kind of see it. Even though I know nothing about soccer, I can see, ooh, look, that guy's starting to cut. Something's going to happen here. Whereas, you know, I think if you don't have a basketball background, I think it's just a harder sport to pick up. Maybe I'm crazy.
No. A lot of the movements are the same. And actually, in comparing and contrasting, a lot of soccer players play hockey, and a lot of hockey players play soccer because some of the movements. And ultimately, you know, it's a sport about not necessarily what happens on the ball, but what happens off the ball. You know?
Right.
And in football, you know, American football, the ball is, you know, that's the most important thing. And, yeah, you can have some different movements, but I can affect a play in soccer, and I can be 40 yards away from the ball. You know, and it's important what I do and how I do it and when I do it. And that's a beautiful thing. And that happens the same in basketball, too.
So looking at the World Cup.
Yes.
We have, it seems like, multiple world-class guys now. Do we have enough to really seriously consider getting into the top eight?
You know what? Well, first off, December 4th this year is going to be very, very important. I mean, let's say that the U.S. qualifies, and I think that they will qualify. December 4th is the draft, the draw in South Africa. So it's where you find out who's in your group. And that's important. Just because you have a good team doesn't mean that you're going to get out of your group. Things happen, even to good teams. So it's important that we get a good group. I do think that we have a team now that has both the ability and the experience. Are we as good as everybody, a few months ago thought we were after the CONCACAF, extravaganza, beating Spain and just losing to Brazil? No. That kind of gave some unrealistic expectations to a lot of people that don't necessarily follow soccer, but that's okay. We still got a long way to go and a lot of work to do. Having said that, we could get out of our group, and then you just need a little bit of luck here or there, and obviously you have to play well, not take red cards, do all those things. So, yes, the possibility exists. I think success for this team right now is getting out of the group, first off. If they don't get out of a group, it's a failure.
How important is my man Jozy Altidore?
He's important. He's really important. He has to play. He's over on loan right now at Hull. And I know you're a big EPL, or you just coming to
it.
EPL right now. So
I saw his big debut, 28 seconds, got an assist.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's excellent.
So he's playing over there, and that's good that he's playing, because the biggest problem with Jozy was he wasn't playing consistently. But he is physically something the likes of which the U.S. team has never seen. Very, very gifted, still growing and still becoming a better soccer player. So he's going to be very, very important going forward for the U.S. For the U.S. team.
And this is really, looking long-term, our biggest advantage is the ability of this country to produce athletes like him. And unfortunately, those guys are playing baseball, football, and basketball for the most part. But, man, when he came into that Mexico game, just the difference in size with him and the Mexican guys, it was noticeable even from the stands.
Well, what's changed in soccer, over the past 20 years is, the physical size of the players. I still get people that don't know a lot about soccer when I tell them I played soccer saying, boy, you're really, really big for a soccer player. And the reality is that even if you look at some of the most skilled teams like a Brazil, these are some big, big guys that also have the skill. So soccer is changing from that stereotypical, kind of short, squat, center of gravity type of player to very, very big. And when you look at, let's take, for example, a Terrell Owen or something like that. I mean, these are the types of bodies and these are the type of athletes that countries around the world have as their soccer players. And it'd be wonderful to have some of the athletes that we have focus on soccer at an early age. But, that'll come with time. There's so many other things that can distract them.
Well, it's really a socioeconomic issue, I think. You need big fields, you need programs, and it seems like it's the wealthier the town or the city or whatever, you're more likely to come out of a town like that than you are to come out of like inner city Chicago and be a soccer player. And I don't know how
to change
that.
There's also the money. I mean, we talk about playing for the love of the game and all that kind of stuff, but the lure and at least the perception that other sports have that this is a way to make millions and millions of dollars, that's very powerful to kids. The whole bling and all that kind of stuff, that's incredibly alluring and powerful when you're growing up. Yeah, I want to do that. And obviously you have to have the ability to even get there. But for a lot of people, soccer isn't necessarily something that is going to lead to the riches that other sports do. And for some kids, that's a turnoff.
Yeah, if you're an 11-year-old and you're much, much better athletically than everybody in your class, you're going to think, I want to be the next LeBron James. You're not going to think, I want to be the next Charlie Davis, because Charlie's not making the same bank.
And you're also probably going to have a mother and father who are practical and realistic about what's going on. And if there is a way to nudge, they're going to nudge to, if this kid's going to spend all his time playing sports and he's really that good, then hopefully he can make a living and he can make a lot of money. And what's the easiest or the safest bet in terms of sports? In America, it's not soccer.
We got to have our dinner argument again, because I was telling you my theory that I thought Allen Iverson would be the greatest soccer player of all time had he concentrated on that from age 8. And you were like adamant, no way, the greatest soccer player if they had concentrated on it from age 8 on and just played soccer would have to be like the Terrell Owens, LeBron James type body.
Yeah.
Defend that point.
Okay, so how tall is he?
Well, Iverson's about 5'10", 10 and a half, I'd say, but he's strong. I mean, he's like really one of the strongest guys ever to play in terms of the amount of times he got thrown down, knocked down, whatever. He just kept getting back up.
All right. I mean, so look, we have, you know, a guy internationally, Lionel Messi, who plays for Argentina, plays for Barcelona, probably, for me, one of the best players in the world. Not very tall. If you saw him walking down the street, you wouldn't pay any attention to him. Problem is that he's a dying breed. There's not a lot of players like that in the world. And size does matter in soccer, and it's mattering more and more. So the ability to have both the physical ability and the coordination, the athleticism, is going to be huge. And I just think we even see it nowadays. I mean, take a Freddie Adu, for example.
Yeah.
Great skill. Problem is, when it gets down to it and the physical part of the game comes in, he gets lost. And so you have to have not just the skill, but also the ability to bang, the ability to withstand people kicking you and doing all that kind of stuff, the ability in the air, all of these things combined. And that's not to say that that the technical side of the game isn't important. It's very, very important. But the best teams in the world, and the likes of a Brazil or something like that, some of these guys are very, very big, but also very, very technical. So I just think that size would win out in the end.
So you're thinking like 6'4 and a half? Something
I mean,
like that?
Not necessarily six. I think you got to be over 6 feet, I think.
Well, I'm saying let's create like the ideal American soccer player. Like if you all had right. to create him in a lap.
Okay.
So you'd want somebody that could go over people for headers, I'm assuming.
Red hair, for sure.
Red hair and beard. See, maybe like somebody like 6'4 and a half, 6'5, who fast as hell, strong.
Yep.
So would that be somebody like maybe like a Scottie Pippen type?
Maybe. It's hard for me because I've never been out there on the court. So some of these guys might be just totally too tall. You know, I mean, I think you need to be over 6 feet, but
not taller than 6'6".
Yeah, I think that's too tall. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're talking the 6 foot to the 6'4".
So maybe somebody like Dwayne Wade. Like I think he's.
Yeah. There you go. That's one. There you go.
So he's like
I could
think,
go with him. Yep.
He lists himself as 6'6", but I think he's closer to like 6'3.5".
Really?
But yeah, and he's physical. He's fast. He's under control. Athletic. Can jump. That's interesting. I'm gonna have to think about this some more. I'd love to know like how big is Josie? Josie's like 6'4", right?
No, not quite. He's big though. He's big and he's strong. And you know they got. You know, very. You know, have to have a big upper body. You have to have that speed, but you also have to have the quickness because, you know, speed. Eventually, people figure it out, and you also have to have the soft feet. You know, a Thierry Henry, for example, who you know plays for France and plays for Barcelona and plays all over the place. He's a very, very big guy. Not necessarily thick guy, but just a big, tall guy, and has speed. He has incredible rhythm with the ball. And just very, very soft feet. So it's not all about the hard.
What about a stopper? What would be the ideal stopper? And you could just say yourself.
When I look out there and I look at, you know, players that are good, I think, you know, like a John Terry is one of the best in the world. You know, when you're a defender, a center back, a stopper, whatever you want to call it, your ability to cut things out and to put out fires before they start is huge. Yeah, there's going to come a time where you have to clean house, and there's going to come a time where you're kind of emergency defending. But when you can cut things out and do it, you know, where you maintain possession, you know, that's huge. So I think if you look at a John Terry, both his physical abilities and his mental abilities to read the game, you know, that's an ideal stopper.
That position is starting to fascinate me more and more as I watch soccer because it's like the no glory position.
Oh,
as
yeah.
you said, your job's to put out fires, but I only notice you if you didn't put out the fire.
Without a doubt. Yep.
It's kind of unfair.
We used to have this argument with forwards all the time. I know I did. I say, you know what? You could play like crap for 89 minutes, and then you're going to score a goal, and you're going to run, and you're going to get all the girls.
Yeah.
I could have the best game of my life for 89 minutes, but that 1 minute that the guy gets behind me or I lose my concentration, you know, and I'm the GOAT. So,
right.
You know, it's the nature of the business and the position.
It's almost like being a hockey goalie, but it's even like you're less visible.
Yep.
You know, or like maybe like the best defensive defenseman in hockey or something like that. But
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, and this is, you know, more of the nuances that you'll see. You'll start to appreciate defenders for what they do and the way that they read the game and the way that they dispossess, you know, their opponent or the way that they tackle, all of these kinds of things. And then there's the other side, you know, for defenders coming up on set pieces, on corner kicks and making themselves visible. It's really the only time that they get a whole lot of praise, and it's very, very obvious as to the effect that they have on a game when they come up and head the ball in and do all these kinds of things.
Why do you think that soccer has the rap of being like a pansy sport, or like it's not physical and all that stuff? Because if you actually watch the games, first of all, it's really physical. Mm-hmm. Second of all, try taking a 60-yard header in the head. Like, not a good time. Not fun at all. Not fun to like go for a header and accidentally hit somebody else in the head. I mean, I would argue it's a more physical sport than basketball in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was certainly an effect of you mock what you don't understand, and, you know, this was a game that wasn't American, and it was being brought over by, people from outside, and, this isn't, people wear shorts and all this kind of stuff. I think that there was just, you know, when you don't understand something, you fear it to a certain extent, and so you come up with ways to downplay it or to make fun of it. It probably happens in a lot of things, not just sports.
Right. So how big do you think, like, for instance, ESPN now televising a lot of this international soccer, just did the deal with English Premier League. People are getting now exposed to this highest possible in soccer, and it's on a lot. And it's on, last week, I think we did a 0.3 for the second game we showed. The first game there was no promotion or anything for it, but not bad for like 7 in the morning or whenever it showed. Do you feel like something's starting to shift here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this summer was big. The only problem, it's not a problem, it's just a reality of the situation, is like unlike other sports, our sport is constantly being compared and contrasted to what goes on around the world. And in a lot of ways, we come up short because we don't have the history. We don't have the 80,000 people. We don't have the huge stars necessarily, and so that can hurt what we're trying to do with MLS. Having said that, there is a huge, huge soccer audience, and ESPN recognizes that, and it's not just because they, like soccer. They recognize it as a business, and they are putting incredible resources. And we'll be ahead of the game when it starts to, become very, very important from a business perspective. There are people there that want to see high-quality soccer. The good part is their affiliations, soccer fans in the United States have both their domestic affiliations, so, they love DC United, but they also have their international affiliations, so they're also a Liverpool fan or something like that. And that's okay, because this is an international game. It's something that I love about it and something that's very, very unique. Problem is that we need to make sure that when they're getting their domestic fix, that they're as entertained and as excited about that as when they're watching games from around the world or when they actually go to games around the world. And that's difficult. It's going to take some time.
Yeah, you're not going to match the crowds. But, I mean, you can even – the goal should be to at least be in the ballpark. And I think with a couple of the stadiums, like, for instance, Seattle, the atmosphere is at least a little bit like it.
Yep.
You're never going to be able to match – White Hart Lane and the Liverpool crowd, any of that stuff.
Well, that's what Seattle's done a good job at, because for a long time, as I said, we kind of made it a Barney show, and it was like this dumbed down version. And the reality is that when you go to a soccer game, yes, we want the families to go, but we also want people to go there and have some beers or take a date and sing songs and be rowdy and have a good time. So it's not just all about the kids, and I think Seattle has a recognition that people are going to go there. It's not rated R, but it's not rated G. It's somewhere in between, and that's good, because that's what sports are, and that's certainly what soccer is around the world.
And don't underestimate the time.
Yeah.
Because these games end in 2 hours. Something to be said for that in this day and age. Trust me, I just sat through 3 straight 4-hour Red Sox games. I mean, it's a long time. That's a pretty big commitment to make to any sporting event, 4 hours. So yeah. when you watch a soccer game, you TiVo or whatever, when it's going to end, basically.
Yeah, and you have kids, and you have, families out there. It's everything's organized and scheduled and programmed and all this kind of stuff. So you want to know what you're getting into. And a soccer game is two 45-minute halves, and you know what you're getting into on the field, you know what you're getting into off the field, and so we do. I think we have a window, and I think what happened this summer with a lot of these teams coming over, and they recognize that there's a huge market over here. It's why they're coming over here. It's not just because they want to play soccer. It's because they want to brand themselves over here in this emerging market. And the amount of people that went to see what they perceived as quality soccer is incredible. So the fans are there. The people are there. We just have to be able to give it to them on a continual basis.
I do wonder how much of it has to do, like if soccer is starting to take off a little bit, like how much of it has to do with that 94 World Cup. And like you think about it, say you're like an 8-year-old in 1994, you're 10 or you're 11, whatever. Well, now you're in your 20s or you're in your early 30s. Now you have money to spend to go see these games. And maybe that was the first time you actually really got a little, caught by soccer a little bit. So now we're seeing like the generations following the 94 Cup. You were there.
Yep, yeah. I mean, they come up to me all the time. I'm walking through airports and stuff and say, my dad sat me down and watched the game against Colombia, or I was at this, I was at the Silverdome when you guys played Switzerland, or, that summer was so awesome, and it was really where I got into it. Because for the first time in American history, people were exposed to what soccer can be when it's played at its highest level with packed stadiums and the passion and the excitement. And for a lot of people, it was incredibly eye-opening. And listen, we're going to get the World Cup back again, and we're going to do it bigger and better. It's going to be awesome. And with all the knowledge that we have and experience in stadiums right now, it'll be the best World Cup that's ever been done. I guarantee it.
What year do you think that would be?
I think it's going to be hard for 18, so I think it's going to end up being 22. It'd be great to have it in 2018. Listen, there's so much politics involved on who gets it, but I think they want to come back to the U.S. because of the amount of money that is able to be made here, and so it definitely will. But I think it's going to be hard for 18, so it'll probably be 22.
Yeah, it seems like some baby steps. Like 94 was the first baby step. Then I think creation of MLS. I think 2002 helped. I think the last World Cup helped. I think Beckham helped a little.
Yep.
And the Confederation Cup last year. And now, like, you see just the HD and all the stuff that kind of makes soccer stand out a little more just watching on television than it did.
Yep. Yeah. Next summer is going to be awesome. I mean, ESPN is blowing it out for the World Cup next summer, and it's
yes,
going to be great. Not just for watching the U.S. team, but for watching all of these teams. It is an event. It is a party, and they recognize that there is an incredible business opportunity, and it's going to be awesome. So we're going to have a good time over there. Some great soccer. It'll be very, very interesting in South Africa and how it all goes about. People are you talk to people, and some people think it's going to be incredible. Some people think it's not going to be incredible. People are just going to be very, very different and unique.
Well, I can tell you that I'm getting emails from people accusing me of talking about soccer and writing a soccer column because ESPN is putting a gun to my head and making me do it, which is always funny, like that I would have no choice in what I wrote about. Like I'm just enjoying soccer. What do you want from me? I think part of it definitely has to do with the fact that we've been showing some of these games. I think it helps to see the best guys in HD on good channels with announcers that I can understand. I'm not,
yeah,
I don't think it's rocket science.
Look, I've spent most of my life explaining soccer to people, and I have no problem doing that. I will sit there and explain the throw-in and offside and all this kind of stuff if people are generally interested in it. What I can't do is people that just don't have the time or the inclination because they don't think that soccer is worth a few minutes of their time. That's a problem for me, especially when we're talking about people that are there to report and talk about sports, because soccer is here, whether you like it or not. And there's also a lot of people right now that want to be involved, and whether it's just out of self-preservation or they recognize that this is a sport that's going to continue to grow, and like a stock, it's headed in the right direction as opposed to other sports, they want to get on that bandwagon. And that's okay. Well, listen, we've got plenty of room on this bandwagon. Come on board.
If you had to pick one guy who will own the 2010 World Cup, who would it be?
Oh, jeez. In terms of just his play throughout the tournament?
Yeah.
On the U.S. or anybody?
No, anybody. Somebody that we'll look back and think, when we think of the 2010 Cup, we think of that guy first.
I think that, let's see, I think that, we talked about him earlier. I think Lionel Messi is coming into his own. He has always been a great player, but I think now he has the experience and he has, you know, certainly has the passion and the drive. I think he's a player to definitely look at.
You got to say the countries for our listeners.
I'm sorry, Argentina. He plays for Argentina, but he also plays over in Barcelona and Spain. And for a lot of people, he is the best player in the world. And, you know, he's the type of player that when he gets the ball, the entire stadium kind of stands up a little bit because you know that there is a potential for something great to happen. And there's not a lot of players in the world. There's a guy like him. There's a guy like Cristiano Ronaldo who plays for Portugal and, you know, now plays over in Real Madrid. And then, you know, you look at Kaká who plays for Brazil. You know, these are all players that have that ability to get the ball and change the game by themselves. And, you know, there's not many of those players out there anymore.
This is a tough question, but because obviously it means an enormous amount to each country, but which country would be the most devastated if it didn't make the finals?
If they didn't make the World Cup next summer, you mean, or the actual final game?
What country would feel the most let down if their team didn't at least make the finals?
I think England's going to make the tournament next year, and they always think that they're the best team and that they should win it all.
Right.
they won't, and...
And they'll blame somebody.
They'll feel let down. I think, legitimately, Brazil right now has the best team in the world, for me. And they are always going to feel let down because they've set the bar so high. And the reality is they are, if not one, then certainly one of the two or three best teams in the world. And so they will be let down. Spain, who the U.S. beat earlier this year, I think really is looking to this World Cup as their moment of glory, because they think that they have all the stars aligned. And Spain, for those that don't know, have been this team where there's been all these expectations and they just never have lived up. And then a few years ago, they won the European Championships, and people think that this is the group to lead them to the promised land. I'm not so sure. I don't think so. The defending champs, Italy, I think are struggling right now. I don't think they look even close to being able to defend that crown. And I think that they will struggle, although defensively they're always going to be tough to beat.
My friend Hopper, who you met in Mexico, diehard soccer fan, thinks that Germany, for some reason, could be the sleeper.
Yeah, I actually picked Germany to win the World Cup.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, you didn't ask me who I picked to win the World Cup.
Well, that was my next question. I was leading up to that. That was my big question.
Yeah, I mean, we do this all the time. We just, you know, it's not based on any kind of scientific equation or any kind of inside knowledge. It's difficult. There are always going to be the usual suspects. There's not a lot of people that are picking Germany. I don't think that people feel that they have the individual brilliance to get them to where they need to be. It's not that they won't get out of their group and go on to the later stages, but they don't think they have enough to get them over that hump. But I'm going to pick them. I just feel like, you know, maybe that South African air, and it's going to be actually cool during the World Cup down there, might be just what they need.
So this is one of the things I love about the World Cup. It's fun to root against Germany. I still have that World War II bias. I just like rooting against them. It's the only sport where you can really, like, get truly xenophobic. Like, Germany, we got to beat the Germans, you know. You call them the Germans and the Italians and the Brazilians. Like, that's always been the thing, even when I was much more casual in 02 and 06. I just love that part of it. It's fun to be xenophobic. It's fun to care about your country.
This pride. I mean, when the U.S. beat Spain a few weeks ago, whenever it was, you know, I was walking through the streets and people were coming up to me that, you know, were like, "Oh, this is so awesome." Because even if you're not into soccer, when your team is playing and they represent your country, and, you know, certainly we have incredible pride here in this country, it's something important. And all these different stories and all these different subplots when countries are playing against other countries, and there's all the socio and the economic and the cultural the differences and exchanges that happen, all this plays into a World Cup. It's an incredible thing to be at a World Cup and to see it. And, you know, for those that haven't necessarily followed a World Cup, get ready, because it'll be awesome. If you're working, just leave work, do whatever you have to do. Even if you're not into soccer, I think it'll be an interesting thing to follow the World Cup for that month. Just pick a team, you know. Obviously, you pick the U.S. if you're a U.S. fan, but pick another team, too, and follow that team.
What's the time difference?
Oh, geez, I don't know. From New York, 7 hours, maybe? I don't know.
I thought it took 24 hours to get there from L.A.
Well, from L.A.
Oh. So it's got to be, well, it'll be interesting to see when the games come on. I'm probably, you know, I'm obviously going to root for America, but I'll probably pick one other country to bet on.
Okay.
So, you know, kind of hedge the bets a little bit so that I'll have a rooting interest in somebody. Although I got to say, I hate England just in every respect, but for some reason I like Gerrard and I like their, you know, Beckham. I feel like I know a little bit. Like, I would watch those games and kind of, I don't know if I'd feel attached, but I would be kind of fascinated by it because I know so many of the guys.
So you're supporting Tottenham this season? That's what's happening?
Yeah, I'm in. I mean, they went 3-0. I put it up for grabs.
They just came to the game and already they got that 3-0. I mean, everybody's going crazy thinking that they're going to win everything.
Well, they had a one game playoff with Liverpool for my affection, won that one. Aston Villa was another team I was looking at. They started out bad, so I kicked them out. And then Hull City, you know, they might get relegated. I can't root for a team that might get relegated. So
that's true.
And also, I feel obligated because I wrote this whole column 3 years ago trying to pick a team, and I picked Spurs. And actually, I had a few readers jump on that bandwagon, so I can't, like, ditch those people. But I do feel like I've been good luck. I feel like I brought some winning experience to them.
Well, you know, I did the same thing, a few years ago. I just totally said, you know what, I'm going to follow American football. And I'm not an American football fan or anything like that. And I watched it for the whole season, and I really enjoyed it. I had a great time watching it. And, you know, listen, soccer players love to make fun of football players, and we
right.
It's like a passion of ours to do that. And I just kind of followed it and just kind of got into it. So, you know, I get it. I get it both ways. I'm not a diehard football fan by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I get the entertainment and the excitement that people have. But I think that there's certainly room for soccer in American sporting landscape.
Well, what team did you pick?
What did I pick? I picked...
you can't even remember.
No, Miami.
Oh, that's a nice one. Well, I think one of the advantages with the Premier League is that it launched during really kind of a sucky month for sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it launched on August 15th when it's kind of the dregs of baseball, like you're getting ready for the pennant race, but it's not really there yet. NFL's still a few weeks away from being interesting and nothing else is going on. So to have something on Saturdays and Sundays in the morning, I actually kind of like. I just like having it on. Do you think this was the greatest 45 minutes of Rob Stone's life? Top
probably.
Three?
Yeah, probably.
Do you want to tell one embarrassing story about him or no?
Rob Stone is for those that don't know, and I can't believe there's people that don't know, the legendary Rob Stone, ESPN broadcaster, commentator, analyst of everything on and off the soccer field and so many other sports and football, and also probably the number one personality when it comes to bowling.
Yes, I would agree.
It's incredible. I mean, I have to sit there and listen to his bowling stories constantly, and it's pretty incredible the things that that he does and that he and his bowling brethren do. It's amazing.
Do you respect his soccer chops because he played in the Patriot League, or do you look down on him for that?
I respect his soccer chops. I don't think I've seen his soccer chops.
Do you get paid? Does the Patriot League, does that earn you chops or no?
Like,
you played in the Big
even
East.
In the Patriot League, like what? Like Oneonta and Hamilton and I don't know.
Oh, Holy Cross?
Oh, really?
Lehigh, Lafayette, American? I can't even remember who else.
What's so they like have co-ed teams or they actually have?
No, they have same-sex teams. Yeah.
Wow, good for them.
It's a source of embarrassment for me because Holy Cross was the 1947 NCAA basketball champs and 1950 NIT champs. And now we're in this league that nobody even kind of understands what it is. It's like not the Ivy League. It's not Division III. We don't know what it is.
Wait, you won the NIT?
Well, we won the NIT back when the NIT was like a real tournament that people cared
about.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. I didn't even know people actually, you know, said that out loud when you won the NIT.
Yeah, no, this was 1950. This was a big deal back then. We had Bob Cousy, we had Tommy Heinsohn. Now it's, you know.
So before before the NIT, was there still the NIT and then the NCAA tournament too?
Yeah, what happened was teams would pick which one they wanted to play for. They were considered equals.
Really?
Somehow the NCAA just pushed aside the NIT, and now it is what it is. It's a tournament for the 65th, to figure out who the 65th best team is.
Wow, I can't believe the NCAA actually flexed their muscles. That's just unbelievable to me.
I know. Did you win a title at Rutgers?
Gentle organization.
Did you win a title at Rutgers?
I didn't. I lost a final to those bastards from UCLA.
Wow. Hey, you were talking at dinner. I thought that was interesting that you weren't even really that heavily recruited, right?
No, I grew up in Detroit, and I grew up actually playing a whole lot more hockey than soccer. And, I made a decision that I really wanted to try to play soccer in college, which was easier said than done. And I got rejected everywhere, all sorts of different places. And my father called Rutgers University and talked to the coach and said, look, I got this kid. He's 6'4", and he's All-State, and blah, blah, blah. And the coach said, well, just bring him out here. Let me take a look at him. And we drove the 16 hours out to Exit 9 off the turnpike there in Jersey. I'd never been to New Jersey, never seen Rutgers. And the coach said, well, look, I can probably help you get into the agriculture school, and I can invite you to preseason. And at that point, that was the best thing I had going, so I said, fine. I did everything wrong in terms of picking a school, but it all worked out okay because it was Division I. They were going through a rebuilding year, and, I spent my first semester going to classes like beef and sheep production.
Wow. And you didn't even have a scholarship for like 2 years, right?
No, yeah. I mean, Michigan wasn't what it is now, and, there's certain hot spots of soccer, and it started to change a little bit. But, I was just kind of this thing coming out of the wilderness into Jersey.
Yeah, I stumped the dinner table when I said how much the situation reminded me of Robbie Benson at the end of One-on-One. When he didn't have a scholarship.
Yeah, you pulled out a Robbie Benson reference down in Mexico City. That, that was worth another round of tequila.
I'll tell you, the dinner table went quiet. The 1979 movie reference didn't really go over that well. But it was similar. After your second year, you were like, hey, give me a scholarship or I'm going to
Robbie directs stuff now. And actually, you can hear him do voiceover work in a lot of commercials if you hear it, if you listen closely.
Yeah, he actually kind of, his voice sounds like mine, so I always notice. I'm a more nasally Robbie Benson.
That's right. You do sound a little like him.
I sound like him and Matt Hasselbeck.
Wow.
All right, Alexa Lalas. So where will we see you on ESPN?
You will see me on ESPN anytime that there is any type of soccer. It is a pleasure.
September 5th. We got to plug those two. September 5th and September 9th.
Yeah, so September 5th,
right?
The U.S. is playing against El Salvador in Utah, Sandy, at Rio Tinto Stadium over there. And it's as much of a must-win game as this team has had in this qualifying process. You come off the loss against Mexico, and listen, let's be fair. If we can't beat El Salvador at home, then we don't deserve to go to the World Cup.
But wait, they've been a little frisky, though.
They're frisky, but we should beat them. I mean, we're at a point now where we're a better team. We're more experienced. We'll be without Oguchi Onyewu, one of our major defenders, but if he's going to miss a game, I'd rather have him miss a game against El Salvador. We're a better team than El Salvador. We should get the 3 points, be professional about it, and then get out of Dodge or Sandy, as the case may be.
And then what's September 9th? Isn't that another one?
Oh, jeez.
I thought there was a second one. It's a tougher game.
Where are we going? We're going down on the road.
I can't remember. There's another game. So El Salvador, if we win that one, we're looking pretty good.
Yeah, that's the one that you need to be watching right now. That's a 3 points. If we get those 3 points, then I think the U.S. I think the U.S. is going to qualify anyway. And for those that don't know, there's six teams playing right now. The top three teams go automatically, and then the fourth team actually goes a playoff with South American team, and we don't want to be that. So we want to be one of the three teams right now. I think that we're sitting in a situation where we get the 3 points against El Salvador, and then we'll be well on our way.
All right. Alexa Lalas, congratulations on breaking your podcast virginity in the BS Report. You were on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Of course. I felt it the entire time.
Okay. And please come back soon.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
So I get the sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.